Hello and welcome to a summer special of the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley and with me is Terry DeFellin.
Hello, Graham.
Hello, Terry. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm a bit tired. I've just erected the big top. It's a Sound of Football summer special, so yes. You've got to have a big top. Hired the circus act. Do they have circus acts now?
Oh, yes, but they're very worthy ones.
Yeah, but they're not like lions and tigers.
No. We've got no animals, no underpaid illegal immigrants. Everyone here is fully licensed and bonded by the local authorities.
Well, that's great. And it looks a good-looking marquee, and I'm looking forward to the show afterwards, and I'm sure the listeners are as well.
Yes, of course. We've got no money left now, though, but hey, yeah, that's what you get for paying reasonable rates to jugglers.
Indeed. Paying jugglers what they're worth.
But yes, these are the things we have to worry about in the summer, you see, because we haven't got football to completely blind us. Or have we?
Or do we?
Yeah.
I believe we do.
Yeah, I think we do.
Football doesn't appear to have stopped at all.
No.
There is less of it, but it is happening all the time.
Yeah, and when it's not happening, we're just talking about people who will be playing football next season, maybe not where they're actually playing it at the moment.
Yeah, there's the Pogba thing, isn't there?
There is the Pogba thing.
It's just a lot of this.
There's the Bale thing as well, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. The Bale thing, yeah, what's that? Is he going to Manchester United or something?
I don't know.
No. Okay. Well, I mean, there's the Bale thing, there's the Pogba thing, and also in Germany there's the Hummels thing.
Ah, yeah.
There's the Hummels back to Dortmund thing, which seems to be a thing, which I think is a mistake, but let's not talk about that. It's almost as if it's just like blokes going, well, there's all this women's football going on, and now we're feeling left out.
Yeah.
You know, they're watching the Women's World Cup and going, when's it the Men's World Cup?
Yeah.
You know, when do we get a Men's World Cup?
Yeah. I don't remember there being a Men's World Cup.
Yeah, apart from last year. Because my short-term memory is rubbish, because I spent so much time on social media that my attention span is fucked, as is my short-term memory. What about the Men's World Cup?
Yes, indeed. Well, the Women's World Cup has been pretty brilliant, though, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has been brilliant. Yeah, what I've seen of it, I'm afraid I haven't been able to watch all of it, sadly. I haven't actually watched a full England 90 minutes yet.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of the games have been kicking off in the middle of the afternoon. That's obviously going to change now because we're getting to the meaty part of the competition.
We are, yeah.
So the earliest kickoffs now are going to be 5:00.
Mm.
Yeah, this is all very good.
Well, if you've got a good data plan and if you're based in the United Kingdom, then it's on the BBC iPlayer on your phone. So you'll be able to either listen to or watch it while you're on your way home if you knock off at 5.
Yeah.
Which I do these days, which is good news.
And the great thing is all the games have been on the BBC.
Yes.
In one way, shape or form.
Yeah, I mean, they've tucked them away on the website or behind the red button, but that's all right. I mean, I appreciate that it's not as popular as the men's game, and so therefore doesn't necessarily warrant coverage on the networks.
And true enough, if BBC showed the whole of the Men's World Cup, it would struggle to free up all of that time in the schedule.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, there are other TV shows and other TV audiences, so yes. But yeah, given the fact that they're showing it exclusively, and perhaps next time round, you know, there might be some arrangement where they should share it. Because some of the ratings have been quite good, and I wonder whether or not ITV might think, this could perhaps roll in a commercial network, albeit perhaps on ITV4.
Yeah.
But I think that ITV might be interested. I mean, Channel 4 showed the Euros.
Yeah, they did.
They shared it with Eurosport last time round. And I was disappointed with some of Channel... I wasn't disappointed with the quality of the coverage. I thought the quality of their coverage was excellent. But I was disappointed that they weren't showing as many games. But fortunately, we had Eurosport to pick up the slack and show the games that Channel 4 weren't showing.
Our friends at Eurosport.
Our good friends at Eurosport.
Yes. Of course, Twitter being what it is, there's always going to be a load of people. If you look for them, you will find them.
Yeah,
if you upturn the rocks, their little Weasley bodies can
be found there. Well, yeah, not if people insist on retweeting this bellendery as well. I mean, I don't follow any of these people, and yet they turn up stinking up my Twitter timeline with their idiotic opinions because someone I do follow is so outraged by them that they insist on sharing it with people. It's like, look, I'm sorry that you're triggered by this asshole, but why are you trying to trigger me?
Well,
I'm not doing anything here.
I'm outraged, and you should be outraged too.
You're the worst of them, Sibley.
Why should I?
Retweeting Bellendery. Come on, man.
Why should I be alone in my outrage? I don't. I just don't think it's fair. I think, if I've got to sit there and seethe, I'm like, damn it, everyone else can sit there and seethe as well.
But we've had it all, haven't we? And some of it has actually been to do with the football.
Yes, indeed.
I think it's one of the probably one of the more meaningful ones with the US versus Thailand, the 13-0.
Yeah.
And the reaction of the US players as the goals are raining in. And then they're not winding their necks back in one iota during it, yeah. Thoroughly enjoying it. Which in some cultures, and I think also perhaps in British culture, people think that that's a bit... And I think maybe in parts of American culture as well, yeah. You know, perhaps where there's things like the mercy rule and stuff like that, where you think you have to be a touch more dignified. But it is a World Cup, and
scoring the World Cup is a big deal.
Yeah. You know, and you have to perhaps think. Now, I personally don't think it looked great, but I'm not going to say that if it had been me, I would have behaved any differently, because that would make me a hypocrite.
Yes. Well, you know how I would have behaved.
Yeah, you'd have been like right in their face, in your face, 13-0, 13, I don't have enough fingers on my hands, you'll be saying to them.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, really, we're not in a position to sort of like judge. So, oh, that doesn't look good.
No, exactly. And let's face it, I mean, USA really do need a win against some Southeast Asian opposition, don't they?
Well, yes, indeed, that's perfectly true. So that's probably what it was all about. It was just a relief. The hoodoo was finally broken. I think it speaks a lot to the distribution of money and income and wealth in the world in general, but in sport and women's sport, in particular women's football.
Yeah.
The Thai national team, clearly, you know, none of them presumably are professional footballers. I know they don't play hardly any fixtures, and so it was going to be a tough afternoon for them. And I can only imagine the courage that they must have shown when they had to turn up a few days later to play again against Sweden. So,
And score. One of the most fabulous moments of the whole World Cup.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's hardly redemptive. But, I mean, the sheer guts to turn up and do it again.
Yeah.
I mean, after that kind of hammering, I can't say that I would have felt that way. I think I would have just hid. So tremendous spirit there. Without wishing to sound patronising, it's not my intention to sound patronising at all. Not something I could have done.
When they got their consolation goal, if you look at it on paper, when they were 4-0 down, it was just about starting injury time, and there was an outpour of emotion there, wasn't there? It was really quite strong, and you know, you had to have a heart of stone not to be moved by it.
I mean, I'm sorry that you weren't moved by it, but the rest of us were.
But however, those cold bastards in the VAR room decided that we're going to give Sweden a penalty just 2 minutes afterwards.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, I don't know whether or not I really want to talk about VAR in this. It's depressing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I was struck by something that Ian King said in 200%. He said the problem isn't VAR, the problem is the rules are bullshit.
Yes, they are. Exactly.
And he's absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, it is bullshit that, you know, that you can be one toe offside. That's crazy.
Yeah.
It is bullshit that you can be fouled outside the box and yet still earn a penalty. But those are the actual laws,
and
the interpretation of the laws, and all VAR is doing is interpreting them with a greater deal of accuracy than a human being would do, than a referee would do, rather. They're in real time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yes, I think there's something in that maybe, you know, we should maybe not be railing against VAR, we should be railing against these laws and how they're interpreted. Maybe there needs to be a liberalisation of that.
Oh, certainly, but the way I look at it now is that VAR was brought in because of the so-called howlers that were being made by referees, and now we're discovering half of these howlers are actually the problems with the laws themselves.
Yes.
That's what the law says.
Yeah. So, I mean, in many respects, VAR has been a good thing, because now it's opening ourselves up. Well, a few months ago, we said it's educating us as to the laws of the game.
Yeah.
But now we're further down the line, we're a few months down the line, and go, no, that's a stupid law. That shouldn't be how it is.
Mm.
That's crazy. I don't care if it is my home team. That is still crazy. So, yeah. I'm still against VAR, but I'm definitely seeing the value in it as an educational tool. What I don't appreciate is what it's doing to players and for them, because for them it's their life, and you know they're spending their whole life, particularly in the Women's World Cup, because so many of them will be semi-professional or amateur. They're turning up for this massive event, and they could have their dreams utterly shattered by petty bureaucracy.
Yeah, I was the victim of VAR. I was one of the many victims of VAR.
Really?
Yeah, as an England fan in
Portugal. Oh, yeah, no, I'm sensing, I feel your victimhood. You would have been in the stadium.
I was in the stadium.
That's right,
I was in line with Jesse Lingard.
Yeah, and you said, that is onside.
I said, that's level.
That's totally level.
He was level.
But VAR disagreed
VAR
with
said
you.
No, yeah.
And VAR, of course, was right. He was about a foot offside.
Yeah.
Literally a foot. Actually, literally half a foot.
Yes.
His little pinky.
Yep, it was a, it was half a foot was offside.
Yeah.
Technically, that's the rules.
Yeah, that's what the rules
any
say.
Any playing part of the body. Yeah.
But I liked the clear air rule. Maybe it would be a good idea to go back to give the clear air rule a bit of another go now that we have VAR. But
now, there is no such thing as level. There is no level anymore because you can go down to the toenail size.
Yeah, either the laws have to be relaxed or players have to work even harder in beating off sidetracks.
Yeah, but this is going to cause more problems when you've got teams that are playing in some competitions with VAR and some when they're not.
That's right.
When, if you're playing a competition where they've got no VAR, you can sit on the shoulder of the last defender and wait to move on it. If you try that in a VAR game, 50-50 chance of being called offside for being in what you think, as anticipate as being a legal position.
As a counter-argument, purely as devil's advocate, surely you don't coach your team to say, right, okay, lads, we're in a VAR league or playing in a VAR competition, a non-VAR competition, therefore we can be a little bit lazier about the way that we do things. Maybe VAR is encouraging better tactics because it's saying, well, you can't play off the shoulder now, mate, because we've got VAR and it's less likely to work. So will I play in the Championship? Yes, but we might be playing in the Premier League next season. Then you'll be coming up next season. You'll be playing like that and, you know, you're going to get caught offside all the time. So actually, maybe that's a good thing because it encourages better play.
Yeah, but what happens if you're, say, let's say you're a defender at a club that is played in a league that has VAR and you're playing in the Champions League that has VAR. So that's all you play. You play VAR football all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then say your team isn't very good in the Champions League and you end up having to play in the Europa League, which doesn't have VAR, not at the moment anyway.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're thinking, well, actually, I'm okay because attackers are now not sitting on my shoulder. But first game in the Europa League where there's no VAR, the attacker's back on your shoulder again, and then you're not used to playing that way. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you're turned inside out.
Yeah, I know. Well, that would be tough shit.
Yes, it is indeed.
I think is what it would
but
be.
But that's what we've got. We're now going to have two systems of playing. That's what I see it as anyway.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's right. And until there's VAR everywhere, that's how it's going to be. And there won't be VAR everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe one day there'll be VAR in every professional football stadium in the UK. That could happen. It's not out of the question.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for example, the Europa League is a good example because there's so many tiny grounds dotted all over Europe that participate in this competition. And, yeah, you'd have to wonder whether or not you can implement VAR for all of those stadia. Or will clubs have to move to VAR-compliant stadiums? In the same way that they move if their stadiums aren't compliant in other ways for European competition. So maybe that will happen. Who knows? I'm not saying it's a good thing, but I don't think it's going away. I know you're of a different view. I think you think that in 2030 it will be forgotten about. Everyone will have scrapped it.
I don't really think that.
But I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's more likely that it will stay. And in every other sport, it's been adopted by everyone's got. There have been enough people who have gone, this is bullshit. But it's still going. Yeah. They're still using it.
But so, after lots of changes, though, that's
yes, yeah, no. I'm certain there'll be changes.
Has been changed quite radically.
Sure, they will finesse it. Yeah. I'm certain they'll finesse it, but it's not going to stop anyway. Let's not talk about VAR.
Let's talk
about football.
Yeah. Okay. Well, do you want me to talk about the rest of the Nations League then?
Yeah. Tell us about your Nations League odyssey.
It was good. I enjoyed it. England were a bit crap. Let's face it. Yeah.
Long season.
Yeah. It looked that way. They looked against Dutch exactly the way that they looked against Croatia in the semi-final. They looked like a side that had finally run out of options. And up against a decent, organised team, couldn't break them down in the midfield. Which was a bit disappointing, really, because they'd given you so much hope in that World Cup semi-final. And, of course, the fact that they couldn't get rid of it.
They couldn't get rid of it. Yes, that's a common refrain in non-league football. Get rid of it! Shouted by supporters and other players.
Yeah, usually I've been totally against the people shouting get rid of it because it's everything that's
anti-football.
Terrible. It's everything that's terrible about British football. And yet it's endemic everywhere. Yeah. And yet the one time you need it, the one time you really, really need it, or the two times you really need it in that Nations League semi-final, it just didn't happen.
I think there's a combination of problems, isn't it? I mean, like, yes, maybe Stone's not the ball player. Playing centre half, we thought that maybe he would become, but yet lack of midfield support, very, very definitely as well. So But I think that that absence of a strong midfield is definitely one of the narratives that emerge from there that I'm on board with. I think that, yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to, you know, the next youngsters coming through, and hopefully we'll get some good midfielders to come and drop in and just give us that. And then they'll be able to make maybe better choices. Or make themselves available and show themselves, you know, for guys like Stones, for the centre halves. It's easy to say, you know, it's easy to blame a centre half for saying, oh, you know, that was a crap pass, and now look at where we are. They say, but it's really, I would say, it's the responsibility of your defensive or deep line midfielders to show yourself for the ball and make it as easy for the centre half as possible. Not even Beckenbauer was playing Hollywood balls, but he was. But, you know, most of the time, I think you'll find he was just playing meat and drink passes, even back then, you know, proper ball playing centre halves. You know, are just competent with the football.
Yeah. The thing is that game was lost a long time before those incidents actually happened.
Sure.
Yeah, if VAR hadn't been there, we would have totally got that goal, would have been given. Mm. I'm sure of it.
Yeah.
Or we would have been moaning the fact that it hadn't been given when it was when they
it
were
would
running.
Have been a rubbish offside call. Yeah.
But the fact is that we all lost our shit in the stadium when it went in.
I bet you did. Yeah. Because it was a cracking goal.
It was a cracking goal. Yeah. There was only a few minutes left and we were totally going through.
Yeah, and then he completely, like, totally passed your buzz.
Yeah. Oh, totally
zapped you with their massive bring down run.
But it is so weird. It really is so weird because you see the VAR thing come up and you think,
oh, bollocks.
God. Here we go. Oh, my God. I've been in grounds for VAR calls before, but I've never really had a vested interest in them.
No.
I've seen them as a neutral, and I think, oh, this is terrible. Look at that. Those guys are really enjoying themselves, and now you're harshing their buzz now. But when it happens to you, and you think, do you really want VAR to just go and die? Mm. And everyone did after that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, hardly surprising.
No one had a good word about VAR in the very level-headed England support that was.
I'm sure they were all very level-headed, sober, well-behaved, measured individuals.
No, they weren't. They were terrible. It was. Porto was full of lads. I actually heard someone say lads, not
lads.
In an ironic way.
Yes. We didn't cover ourselves with glory there, did we?
Well, I was fine.
Found a nice place to go and drink some port.
Oh, no, I did.
Middle-class England fans who have got their little enclaves, particularly in Porto, where they can ferret themselves off to and get away from the hoi polloi.
But it was an odd mix. You could see the sort of like the classic England right-wing thug. They were the ones that you think, yeah, okay, you're best avoided. There were the middle-aged travellers who have been following England, rolling their eyes whenever they see loutish behaviour, but not really saying anything. That's sort of probably where I'll be in about 5 years' time, I think. But then there was the vast majority of them, which were really just stag do revellers, really.
Right.
Young guys, probably in their 20s, early 30s. Really just getting absolutely hammered because they're away for a long weekend.
Just behaving like they own the place.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Being dicks, basically.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound like the kind of bloke who goes away to watch England and say, well, I didn't see any trouble. There weren't any trouble where I was. That's basically because I avoided the areas where they were. But most of the time when you saw them, they were loud, they were obnoxious, but they didn't strike you as trouble. And when I heard about the fact that there had been ugly scenes in the middle of town. I don't know which area it was. It was in one of the fan areas that they'd set up in the main square. It was the sort of thing, well, it only takes one dick to throw a bottle. And then everyone gets angry. Everyone loses it. And they were just drinking and drinking and drinking all day. Because there's nothing really else for them to do.
No.
And they don't want to do anything else.
No,
so they just, all they want to do.
They've literally come there for that.
Yeah, they just want to go there and drink and have their version of a good time. Which is probably no one else's version of a good time.
Yeah.
But as I say, it was easily avoided. I didn't feel the need to spend too much time with them, except in the ground when you couldn't really escape them. I went with my wife and she said, nah, not doing that again.
No.
And I'm not surprised. No. I've been to quite a few international tournaments and I've never actually gone to see England in an international tournament. So I'm glad I've done it. I'm not sure if I'm going to do it again.
No, fair enough.
Because they're just not really my sort of people, really.
Fair enough. I've never done it. I've never travelled to see an England game.
You've been to World Cups before?
Yeah, absolutely, so. And the atmosphere's been vibrant, I would say. Cordial. Everyone's having a great deal of fun. And that's not so there isn't beer being consumed. And I've been in plenty of stadiums where there's beer being consumed. After all, I'm a fan of German football.
You are indeed,
and I'd
yes.
go to German football grounds. And my God, they put that beer away. I've not really encountered that level of obnoxiousness that people have encountered. But I wonder whether or not, to an extent, it's also because they're your own fellow countrymen. So maybe you also feel a degree of sort of embarrassment and association, because they're, you know, these people could probably be your neighbours or your live round the corner from you.
I certainly bloody hope not.
Well, certainly not round here anyway.
But when I was on the way back, I started reading a book. I started reading this book called Football, The Philosophy Behind the Game.
Did you?
Yes. Because, you know, after you've been knocked out of a tournament, you get a bit philosophical about the game, don't you?
Yeah.
And I thought I'd read this. It's full of wonderful insights in the game.
Fantastic.
We were sent this by the good people at Polity Books. And it's written by Professor Stephen Mumford, who is the Professor of Metaphysics at Durham University.
At Durham University?
Yes.
University.
I think that makes him a Ghostbuster. I think. I enjoyed it so much that I thought we'd get him on. I gave him a call earlier. Do you want to listen to it?
Yeah, I would love to listen to it.
Good. Here it is. Welcome to the show, Stephen Mumford.
Hello.
Stephen, we were very kindly sent a copy of your book by your publishers, Polity. The full title is Football, The Philosophy Behind the Game. Now, I'm really surprised there aren't more football philosophy books, because really, almost anyone you talk to seems to style themselves as a football philosopher in some way.
Yeah, I think it is becoming a lot more fashionable. And now I hear of coaches speaking and being interviewed, and players being interviewed. And one thing they often say is that the coach has to have a philosophy, an overarching, driving, basic view that they feel determines how they play the game. And it's almost as if you don't have a philosophy of football, then there's no point playing it.
This is a philosophy in even wider respect than either something like an overall strategy, which would be different from, say, on-the-field tactics. This is something almost encompassing of what a club is, like we would say perhaps the Liverpool way or the West Ham Academy, where supporters of a club can believe that their club is different in some way and has a philosophy, or it reflects their worldview in some respect.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, if you take West Ham, as a Sheffield United supporter, West Ham aren't my favourite other club, but they've had a long-standing philosophy. They think the game should be played a certain way. They traditionally, I don't know, things have changed in recent years, but the idea was that they didn't want to win ugly. They wanted to play a passing game. They wanted to play beautiful football. And I agree that people might just think it's not their club if they don't embody that philosophy.
Now, the book is broken down into an introduction and five chapters afterwards. And the first chapter is about beauty, where you take the trope, the beautiful game, head on. I found that very interesting to read that, because everything about beauty is in the eye of the beholder. When you were writing this book, was this something that you'd been thinking about for a long time, or had you separated football from your day job until you thought, right, okay, now that I'm thinking about this, this is what's going on here?
I do sort of more mainstream philosophy usually, but yeah. I'm also a big football fan myself. And so, you know, what a great idea to bring the two things together. But I have done a bit of more serious philosophy of sport as well, going back. So I do have an earlier book on watching sport, and a lot of that was about the aesthetics of sport. So there is an existing literature in journals such as Journal of the Philosophy of Sport. Right. There's some long-standing debates going back to the 1970s about whether sport is ever really art. I don't think anyone doubts that it can embody aesthetic value, that you can find beauty in sport. But then there's other questions about, well, does that make it really art? So one argument discussed in the book is, although football produces beauty, it doesn't actually seem the aim of football. Football's about victory. It's about winning. It's only when the teams and the players are going for victory that they manage to produce beauty. So if a player was just trying to be beautiful, then I don't think they'd succeed. It's got to be in the striving for victory.
In that strive for beauty, or beauty being a byproduct of the game, you mentioned about how people view the game differently if they're partisan or neutral, and about how if you're neutral, then a play can be amazing. But of course, if it's against your team, all you can see is the deficiencies in your own defence, or just any excuse just to blow your top at the manager or the owners of the club. I found that particularly fascinating and eye-opening. But it also seemed to resonate with me at the moment, because at the moment we're in the middle of the Women's World Cup, and my Twitter stream is full of people who are very, very interested in it. But there is also a lot of people who aren't interested in it at all, and actually quite antagonistic about it. People who actually seemed in some ways threatened by it. Do you think this is an extension of that? This sort of people are being partisan about the sport rather than as a club and being protective of it? Or do they think that the beauty that they see in the men's game is not something that they actually can see or want to see in the women's game?
Well, that's a really difficult question, because, I mean, you're right that some people are antagonistic towards it, and it may just be sexist attitudes. But to produce really beautiful football, you do need to have the kind of athletic excellences that make it so good to watch. And I think football looks the most beautiful when it involves power and speed. So if you watch a very low standard game, you don't have those qualities. And, you know, that makes it less good to watch. But I've got to say, I've watched lots of the games in the World Cup this year, and I think the women's game has really come on leaps and bounds. I mean, if you watch the USA team, they are as strong and powerful and skilled as you're going to get most men's teams. So I think we've really reached a turning point in the women's game, I think. When I watched the women's football 20 years ago, I don't think it had quite the same level of excellence. Now I think it's really superb. So I think if anybody has got the mind close to it, then I think they've got to come around to it, because I think so far this World Cup's been great.
It certainly has. It's providing a lot of entertainment. And of course, as the teams remaining are whittled down to the strongest ones, then we're going to see even more quality coming out. I would struggle personally to remember a World Cup where the group stage was completely awash with talented teams playing beautiful football. I don't think that really has ever happened. Of course, there's been a lot of VAR in this tournament. There was a lot of VAR used in the recent Nations League as well. And it really is bringing it home now to a British audience just what VAR is going to mean to them next season when it's brought into the Premier League. You do brush on VAR in the book, very, very lightly, because this was written when you were watching the World Cup last year.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So
the Men's World Cup.
Yeah, the Men's World Cup. What's your opinion as far as VAR is concerned to the sort of natural flow of the game? When people say, oh, it's not football, does that get your philosophy alarm ringing and saying, right, okay, what are they actually talking about here?
Well, I'm feeling a bit sceptical about the VAR at the moment. I mean, one thing is that it hasn't stopped the argument. So I watched the Sweden against Thailand game yesterday, and Sweden were awarded a penalty in added time for a handball. I mean, as far as I could see, there's no way that should be given as a handball. But so, you know, we can see the same pictures, and we're still going to have those opinions. I think people were looking for a kind of magical solution to these disputes. The referee could see this, and we know for sure whether it's a penalty or not. And I don't think anything's going to be able to do that. And I fear that it has taken something of the aesthetic from it. So next season when I'm watching Sheffield United in the Premier League and we score a goal, I don't think I'm going to be quite able to have that absolute moment of thrill going crazy when you scored, because then everybody's going to be waiting. Oh, is it going to be reviewed? Is it going to be reviewed? So the goal isn't really scored until the moment that the VAR team clear it and the referee clears it. So, you know, you're still going to have goals and everything, but I just think it's taking something. One thing about the aesthetic of football has always been that supreme moment when the ball crosses the line and you go from nothing to complete ecstasy. In football, you can get goals scored in a fraction of a second. And now it seems to actually score the goal is going to take minutes between the ball crossing the line and then the VAR team are going to be looking for the offsides or any infringement. Eventually, you get the call that the goal stands or it doesn't. So I'm a little bit worried that it's going to change the experience of watching football.
When I read your introduction and you were talking about the fact that about football is that split second thing, which is when you're comparing it to rugby, and it was something I hadn't really thought about before. There are plenty of reasons why football and rugby are different, but most of them are social. They're about class and about how you perceive yourself in society. But it's very rarely that you actually say, well, this is a sport difference between the two. This is a difference in the aesthetic of the games. And the fact is that football can just turn on its head within a second. A goal can fly in from 30 yards out. A try can be scored from 50 yards out, but you'll see it coming a mile off. And I thought that was a very, very clear difference as to what makes football so wonderful. And of course, as you said, with VAR, some of that is going to disappear. When that happens, you're not going to be able to get it back, are you?
No, I mean, I think once VAR is introduced, it would be very hard to stop it because people would feel, whether you can't trust the decisions anymore.
I think you've
got to be very careful to tinker with football. I think it's so finely balanced. I think football is such a perfect game. I think it's no coincidence that it's the world's most popular spectator sport. And, it's easy to come along and think, oh, well, if we just did this, if we abolished the offside rule or something. These tiny changes could make a huge difference to the experience of watching. I think you've just got to be so careful. On the rugby, I grew up in West Yorkshire, and we actually watched Rugby League, which was still quite a working-class game, and I think it is now. And I used to go to some rugby games, which I mentioned in the book, and it just never gave me the same thrill, even when a really skillful try was scored. So that's why in the book on football, I sort of reflected on, why is it that football is such a perfect game? I mean, it is, in my opinion. In the book, I make no secret of the fact that I think it is the greatest game of all. So I think that's the sort of thing that there ought to be an analysis. There ought to be some explanation about the nature of football itself, about why it's so great.
Well, this book really does sum up quite a lot of things in there. There's a lot of things as well that I think you've left it open as well, I think, for a second book on this or more books to come out in the future, which I hope they do. As I said, it's published by Polity. Politybooks.com is where you can get it. I will put links to where you can get hold of this book. It's part of a series as well. The other ones in this series by other authors include Conspiracy Theories and White Privilege, which makes it sound about 90% of my Twitter stream. So I encourage you to read the book. And Stephen, you've been a great guest. And hopefully when you're back in the UK, I know you're in Spain at the moment, but hopefully you can come back onto the podcast another time and we can discuss more philosophy of football at a later stage.
That would be absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I'd love to do that.
Stephen Mumford, thank you for coming on The Sound of Football.
Thank you.
Well, that was good, wasn't it?
That was great.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
A lot of insight there, wasn't
there? Yeah. Maybe I'll buy that book myself. or maybe I'll let you lend it to me. Sorry, Stephen. No, I'll definitely be buying that book.
Yeah, so as I said, we'll put all the details up there on the website, so you'll be able to find out where you can get a copy of it yourself. But, I think that's enough for this summer special. I think we've brought you back up to speed. You can go back to your pointless transfer speculation and maybe looking out and seeing who's going to be your stellar pick for your fantasy league team.
Or you could watch the football, watch the Women's World Cup.
You could certainly
which
do
is
that.
A lot more wholesome activity.
Our listeners are watching it anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure our listeners are discerning and will be watching it. And maybe they'll be watching the Africa Cup of Nations, which is just over a week away.
Yeah, they might be even staying up and watching the Copa America
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the channel of which Copa America is on, and it's just as well because it's on at stupid o'clock in the morning.
You'd feel like you had to watch it, wouldn't you?
I would feel like I'd have to watch it, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what's going on with these crazy South American times? I mean, it's a good job Jan's not here, otherwise he'd say something really disparaging about the South Americans, because you know how he is with those South Americans.
I know how he is with those South Americans, yeah.
But we will be probably record another one ourselves, won't we? We're going to France.
We are going to France. We're going to France at the end of the month. We're going to go and see three quarterfinals.
Three quarterfinals.
Yes.
Subject to cars staying on the road and all of that.
Yes, indeed. And by the way, the way it's looking at the moment, France are going to be topping their group, and USA, it's going to take something really weird for them not to win their group. So it's looking like we're going to see France versus USA in Paris.
Yeah, assuming they get through their second round draws, and we're all assuming that they will. I think we're all assuming USA are going to win the World Cup, aren't we?
Well, they look like it. They look frightening, don't they?
They do, but the US have got to play Sweden next, and Sweden are good.
Yeah.
And so far, USA have only played, well, bluntly, not very good teams.
Yes.
I mean, we'll see what they're like when they're not sort of like lining up six up front.
Yeah.
You know, see what they've got to play against a decent team that's going to hit them on the break and is going to score against them.
Yeah, and can play out the back.
Mm. Our friend Patti LaBella had said that she had concerns about the outside backs, the full backs.
She certainly did.
And I guess the Swedes will probably be looking to exploit that, and indeed others. So who knows?
Yeah, I don't know if the listeners have noticed, but I think the full backs play such a key role in this because there's so much playing out from the back.
Sure.
It's so it is a very, very key role in the women's game. So yes. It's... But I'm sure you've noticed that already, haven't you, by looking at all the games that have been on.
Yeah, I mean, they would have got much... I mean, they would have scored a lot more, in fairness, against Chile if it weren't for their goalkeeper, Christiana Endler, who was outstanding.
Yeah.
One of the best goalkeeping performances that I've seen in an international tournament.
Yeah, I mean, coming straight after Correa's performance against England for Argentina, which was another amazing performance there.
Yeah, of course,
And people have been saying, oh, you should make the goal smaller.
And the age-old refrain about women goalkeepers being rubbish is clearly rubbish in itself.
Yeah.
Because we've seen some outstanding goalkeeping.
Yeah.
The whole, you know, make the goals smaller, make the pitches narrower, make the women taller.
Make them more men.
Yeah, turn them into men. You know, that kind of thing.
Yes.
We've heard it all on Twitter, haven't we?
Frankly, we have indeed.
Nothing's off the table when it comes to Twitter.
No, sadly. Sadly, it's not. But yes, we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with our report... From France.
We will be recording from... I mean, you probably won't know. We might as well be recording outside. But
no,
we'll try and record some stadium atmosphere.
I'll get some accordion playing in the background.
You've got to get some accordion there. That maybe, you know, there's a man on with a...
Onions!
Selling onions, which I assume is very commonplace in France.
It certainly is. Every corner. Yes, lots and lots of mild xenophobia, which is what you should have with two English guys when they go to France. Yes.
Cheers.
We'll be recording from the car park of the hypermarket as we load up our cars.
The only thing you'll hear is a clink and clink clunk of bottles of wine, cheap bottles of wine being packed into the back of a Ford Fiesta.
And I'm sure you can't wait to listen to that.
It doesn't get more English, does it?
Doesn't really, no. But for now, from me, Graham Sibley, and from Terry DeFellin, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
Au revoir. Santé. Zut alors.